This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The HBO series In Treatment started its new season last week. It stars Gabriel Byrne as Paul Weston, a psychotherapist who is insightful about his patients' problems, but has great difficulty coping with his own. At the end of last season, he and the therapist who was treating him parted ways. He has a new therapist this season, played by Amy Ryan. In Treatment was adapted from an Israeli series, and the first two seasons revolved around stories from the Israeli show. But this season, all the stories are original. My guests, Dan Futterman and Anya Epstein, are the new showrunners, and they wrote the new episodes revolving around Paul and his therapist. Futterman also wrote the screenplay for the film Capote. He starred as journalist Daniel Pearl in the film A Mighty Heart and played the straight son in the film The Birdcage. Epstein wrote for the series Homicide and Tell Me You Love Me. Epstein and Futterman are married. Each episode of In Treatment is a therapy session. There are four episodes each week. The first three feature Paul and his patients. The fourth episode is devoted to Paul's sessions with his new therapist. Here's an excerpt of a session with Paul and Jesse, a 16-year-old who is gay, has had multiple partners, probably unsafe sex, and feels unwanted by his adopted parents. Jesse is played by Dane DeHaan.
Have you been having trouble sleeping?
No. Have you?
Have you been taking your Adderall?
You mean if I've been selling my Adderall?
That's not what I said.
Yeah, but that's what you actually want to know, isn't it?
You seem pretty anxious today. Just trying to figure out why.
Well, I don't have to sell that anymore. My ship's about to come in.
What do you mean?
Do you want to see something awesome? It's this new app I got. It's called Hoser. You just open it, and it finds out where you are. It tells you exactly where the closest hookup is. Over 1,500 guys join it every day. That's weird.
Jesse.
Wow, your office is like a dead zone, dude.
Can you put that away, please?
You're like an anti-sexual force field around this place or something?
I'm not going to ask you again. Put it away.
All right.
Dan Futterman, Anya Epstein, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the show. Now, this season is the first season in which the series is starting from scratch. The first two seasons were based on the Israeli series. So starting from scratch, as opposed to using an Israeli template, did you want to make major changes in the style of the series or the kinds of relationships between patient and therapist?
We were both tremendous fans of the first two seasons, hadn't seen any of the Israeli series before we started working. So I think our primary concern was how can we keep the show consistent and match the quality that we had so admired. But given that, I think we also did try to think about, starting from scratch, what could we do different or what do we want to do differently?
And how did you answer that?
Haggai Levy, the Israeli creator, set up a great template in that this therapist is not just any old therapist. It's a therapist who's specifically challenged by his patients in that he's always having to figure out how far do I go? Do I cross the line with this patient? Am I interested in this patient, jealous of this patient, angry, turned on? And that has continued in the American series, and that became the challenge for us to find storylines that would awaken different parts of Paul Weston and tempt him to either cross the line or hold back. For Paul Weston, the Gabriel Byrne's character, that's his drama throughout all these sessions. How far do I go? How much am I tempted to cross lines with these patients?
We wanted to do that without repeating the same dynamics that Haggai had landed on and done so well. So, you know, we felt that we had seen two male patients so far that Paul sort of entered a confrontational dynamic with. And we thought, okay, what kind of male character can we bring in where the dynamic is different? And that led us pretty early on to Irfan Khan's storyline.
Well, let's talk about that storyline. He's a Bengali man whose wife has died, so he's moved to Brooklyn to live with his son and his daughter-in-law, who's American-born. But he's very unhappy living with them. You want to explain why?
Well, first, I want to say that we, you know, in in talking about how do we challenge Gabriel, having been through a number of patients in the first two seasons, how do we continue to challenge him both as character, Paul, and also as an actor? And one of the things we landed on was why don't we just cast the best actor in the world to play opposite him? And, you know, somebody's got to be the best in the world. I think it's Irfan Khan.
He's great. He's really great.
He is amazing. I mean, who knows on the female side? Who knows? You know, maybe Meryl Streep, Tilda Swinton. Who knows? I think it's Irfan Khan on the male side. So that was thrilling to us to have him finally agree to do it. And I think really exciting to Gabriel. For the question that you asked about the character, he's lost his wife about 6 months ago. He's been transplanted to Brooklyn and living with in a very Americanized household. His son, who used to be Arun in Calcutta, has since he attended university and met his now wife. Is calling himself Aaron, and they're raising their children in a very Americanized household. And his daughter-in-law, played terrifically well by Sonia Walger, is both a little harsh, critical, and also provocative in certain ways towards Sunil, Irfan's character, in ways that he finds both intriguing and confusing and somewhat angering.
So let's play a scene here. And before we do, I should mention that Irfan Khan was in the movie The Namesake, playing the father. He was very briefly in Darjeeling Limited, playing the father of a son who is killed. And Dan, you starred with him in the movie A Mighty Heart, in which you played Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street journalist who was beheaded in Pakistan, and he played an inspector?
Yeah, sort of the chief Pakistani inspector, trying to find him and then find out who did what they did.
I should mention that, of course, Irfan Khan was in Slumdog Millionaire and neglected to mention
that.
Right. That's right.
As the inspector. So, okay. So here's a scene from In Treatment from the first episode that Irfan Khan is in. In this scene, Paul, the therapist played by Gabriel Byrne, has finally gotten the character Sunil to speak, because at the beginning of the session, he refuses to even speak. That's how alienated and depressed he is. But he's finally speaking now, and they're talking about basically how uncomfortable he is in America.
It must be very difficult, the loss of a wife, displacement from your country, feeling trapped in a house that you're not made welcome, where you don't feel you belong.
Whatever makes you say that, Dr. Weston, I have so many things. I have my small room, my child's bed, my flat screen TV, my Sarojini. So there has been a discussion about another child. So they will eventually turn my room into baby's room.
And where would you go?
Basement. Where there's not so much sunlight, so I'll have to leave my poor plant upstairs. You're not from here either?
No, not originally, but we moved here when I was... when I was a kid.
I had an Irish friend in the university. I recognize the accent. They're waiting for me.
I'm very glad that you came in today, Mr. Sanyal. And I just want you to know that I would like to help you in any way that I can.
Perhaps you could write me a prescription that would allow me to return to India, where my wife would be alive.
Okay, that's a scene from In Treatment, and my guests, Dan Futterman and Anya Epstein, are the showrunners for this HBO series, and they write one of those storylines. You've talked about making the series more American now that you're not taking the storylines from the Israeli series. And this is such an American story, the story of, an immigrant coming to the United States and maybe, certainly in his case, being uncomfortable, feeling alienated. So is that one of the reasons why you wanted to write the storyline in addition to wanting to write for Irfan Khan, the actor?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, we were also very aware that in addition to being an American story, this seemed like a very New York story as well. And Paul Weston this season and last has moved to Brooklyn. And I think I read an article in the New York Times called The Invisible Immigrants about older immigrants coming to America. It focused on immigrants from India and the troubles they faced adjusting, not coming to America to make their fortunes and seek out their dreams, but often to live with adult children at the end of their lives and suffering from loneliness and depression, but not having any outlet for that, and often not having psychotherapy be part of the, you know, their culture. So that's really where it came from. And it did seem like an American story and not one that they might have told in the Israeli series.
In this series, the character that Irfan Khan plays is very uncomfortable with therapy because in India, he says, therapy is just for people who are severely mentally ill. He doesn't even want to be called a patient because patient means you're in the hospital. So he's, even though he's kind of warm to it a little bit, he's pretty anti-therapy. And I'm wondering how familiar Irfan Khan was with American-style psychotherapy.
Not at all. I mean, I think he knows about it, but I think he has an equally suspicious judgment of therapy. I know that he has not been in it, and he does. I don't think he knows anybody in India who is in therapy. So he was very interested and comfortable playing that part.
That part of the man who's uncomfortable.
Him.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's right. That's right.
We wanted him to end up in therapy by the end of the summer, but we didn't succeed.
You know, part of this storyline, we're talking about finding characters that would awaken something in Paul.
Oh, I just got it. You wanted Irfan Khan to be in therapy, the actor himself.
That's right. That's right.
Delayed
yes.
reaction.
Right. Instead, he's talking about buying an apartment in the East Village, which he fell in love with, which would be great. And he wants Adam Rapp, the writer of that storyline, to write a play for him so he can come live here and act in a play.
Now, you reserve for yourself the storyline of Paul being in therapy. In previous seasons, Paul's therapist was played by Diane Wiest, and she was so wonderful in that part.
She was.
And she was both very wise in the role, but at the same time, there was constant conflict between them because there's this whole back history where he believes, Paul the therapist believes, that it was because of her that he was never promoted to direct a psychiatric institution where they'd both worked. And she'd been his mentor, and anytime she criticized him, he took it as a personal affront. So it was a very uncomfortable relationship that they always had. Did Diane Wiest leave the series, or was she written out of the series because it was time to move on for the character? Like, what happened that she's not in it anymore?
We thought that story had played itself out, that he had left her care as his supervisor, and then left her care again as a patient. That she had seen him and his wife as a couples therapist. She had been his mentor and teacher, and that story had kind of played out as much as we felt we'd be able to play it out this season.
I also think Warren Light, the showrunner of season two, had ended that storyline on a very final note where Gina's character says, "This is the moment where I should be saying my door is always open to you, but I'm not going to say that." So I think we felt it would have been a lot of manipulation and maybe awkward manipulation on our part to open up that storyline again.
So the new therapist that you hired to work with Paul is Amy Ryan, who's also really terrific. Why did you want her? And people will know her from a variety of roles, from her comedic role on the NBC series The Office, from her role in Gone Baby Gone, which is a crime story based in Boston. And she's mean in that. She's cold. So why did you want her for this?
They may also know her from the movie Capote, which I wrote, and she played Marie Dewey, Chris Cooper's wife.
Oh, of course, wasn't putting that together, right?
And she's someone who I've acted with in New York in readings, and Anya cast her. She's a little bit of our
Good luck charm.
Good luck charm, yeah. Angel and our relationship, when we all worked together. When I first met Anya, when she wrote a homicide episode that I acted in, Amy was also in that episode. And we've been friends ever since. And I think she's just wonderful. She seemed the perfect person to play opposite Paul, both in terms of her wisdom and gentleness, but she can, as you said, also be tough. And we wanted someone to be tough with him in ways that Gina, the Diane Wiest character, had such a complicated relationship with him that we wanted to, and was not probably the most effective therapist for him because of that. We wanted to see what would happen when someone was detached, tough, and because of that detachment, very intriguing to Paul.
And I'll also add to that list, highly, highly intelligent. I mean, I think we were a little self-conscious about the fact that we were coming in and replacing Diane Wiest's character, whom we loved so much, but who was an older woman, you know, with a woman 20 years younger. And we were afraid of being criticized for coming in and just sexing up the show a little bit. And it was very, very important to us that we found someone who, you know, was not only young and attractive, but who was to be taken very, very seriously by Paul and also by the audience. And Amy combined all of those factors in a great way.
So you needed to find an excuse for Paul to go back into therapy. Not that he needed an excuse, because he can really use the therapy. but he wasn't really ready to sign up for it. So what excuse did you come up with?
Well, the excuse that he, at least that he gives himself, is that he needs, he's having a terrible time sleeping. He is convinced himself because of some hand tremors that have set in over the past several months that he is developing Parkinson's, with the disease that his father died from in the last season. And he's having a terrible time sleeping and needs a refill on his Ambien prescription, and his Baltimore doctor refuses to do it anymore long distance and insists that he find someone in New York, and his doctor in New York recommends, why don't you just go see Adele Brouse, played by Amy Ryan. She can refill it. Tell her what's going on. And he finds his way into her office hoping to get a prescription and leave. And she says some very incisive things that cause him to decide to come back.
Yeah, so let's play a scene from Paul's first session with his new therapist, a psychiatrist, actually, played by Amy Ryan. And in this scene, he's kind of testing her to see, you know, how smart she is. And he's basically asking, you know, oh, have you heard of Gina Toll, my former therapist? You know, she's very famous. You know, she's one of the most famous, you know,
that's right,
one of the best therapists on the East Coast. Oh, so you haven't heard of her, huh? They're kind of going back and forth on this. And then Adele, the psychiatrist, starts asking him some pretty incisive questions, for instance, about his relationship to his father. And Paul's very impatient with all this questioning. He feels like he's been through it before. He doesn't want the therapy. All he wants is his prescription. So let's pick it up there.
Please, enough. I've been over this 100 times with Gina. About my anger at my father for walking out on us when I was a teenager. My mother's suicide when I was 17. My need to save people as a result. I've been over this again and again with one of the best analysts on the East Coast. I do understand it all. There's really nothing more for you to contribute to that.
I just want to make sure I understand something.
Sure, fine.
You said Gina Toll was your teacher.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then she was your supervisor?
Yeah.
And after that, your analyst?
Yes.
And she also saw you and your ex-wife as a couple's therapist?
Mm-hmm, correct.
Yeah, I see.
What do you mean, you see? What are you implying?
Oh, I'm not implying anything. I'm just trying to understand the methods of one of the best analysts on the East Coast.
Ouch. So does what she is saying in that scene reflective of what you thought of the relationship between Gina and Paul in the first two seasons?
I think it's one of the things that made that relationship so interesting and so complex, and probably ultimately not terrific therapy for Paul, which was, I don't think, the intent that she was to be the best analyst for him. It was that, let's put two people in a room who have a very complex past and make good drama out of that. She is having a very hard time with Paul, and so she says something purposely provocative to finally break through this shell. We had a lot of discussion. We had a psychiatric advisor on this season. He also was on last season helping Warren Light run the show. And we had a lot of discussion about this line, which he said was really too provocative.
Last line, I want to see.
Yes, that's right.
the methods of the best therapist on the East Coast, that line?
That's right.
That's right. Too snarky, he said.
Yeah. But we thought, you know what, we're not doing a documentary about therapy where you try to compress so much into such a short period of time. And the real challenge is to get good drama out of it. And as long as she's aware of what she's doing, let's just have her do it.
I want to play another scene that you've written for Paul and his new therapist, or psychiatrist, I should say. And in this part, you know, Paul has brought with him a new novel written by his former therapist, the character Gina, played by Diane Wiest in seasons 1 and 2. And he's just bought it after seeing an ad for it in the newspaper. And, you know, he's kind of talking about how his great former therapist has written this book and everything. He's looking at the book, showing it to his psychiatrist, and now he's looking at the book jacket photo of his former therapist. And you mentioned snarky. This is going to be a little bit snarky.
Yeah, it's a pretty good photograph. It's airbrushed, but she looks great. Great big smile. Very pleased with herself. I would be with blurbs like these.
You've read the back.
Insightful and sharp. A masterful spin through the tortured human psyche. That's Laurie Moore. Wise and deeply empathetic. Amy Bloom. I guess it's good.
How does it feel reading those quotes? Well, that's high praise for a woman whose talent and intellect you say you respect, and yet you read that.
I'm happy for her.
Okay.
I'm not claiming it's not complicated. There's not some jealousy, sure, but of course. I should wait till I read it myself. But I'm pleased for her. Yeah.
What are you jealous of?
Well, clearly she's made a new life for herself, found a way to escape from patients like me. Quite a feat, really. Phoenix-like.
Why are you so convinced Gina wanted to escape from you?
Well, give me another 10 minutes and you'll understand completely. You're probably feeling it already.
No, I hadn't.
Well, you're extremely polite.
Do you feel that way with your patients, like you want to escape?
Well, I told Gina once that with patients, I feel like it's like two mice in a glue trap, stuck, immobile, getting nowhere.
So that's a scene from the new season of Entreatment, and this part of the storyline is written by my guests, Dan Futterman and Anya Epstein, who are also the show's showrunners. So he says that being a therapist with a patient is like being two mice in a glue trap, stuck and immobile. But the thing is, at the end of every season, most of his patients have some kind of revelation or awakening or a big change in their life. So he's actually a pretty effective therapist, except for the fact that he gets too emotionally involved or sometimes too sexually involved with his patients. And I'm wondering how you're going to handle that, if you want that kind of epiphany, or if you feel like that is too dramatic, you know, the therapist rescuing people and having an epiphany at the end of the season.
You know, I spent 7 years in therapy. I'm not sure that I had any epiphanies myself. So I think we're probably more skeptical of that kind of a story arc than others might have been. I think one thing we were interested in doing this season, we're having some surprises. Things happen in these treatments that are probably not what one expects will be the epiphany that these patients will have, nor the epiphanies that Paul may have. So we were interested in spinning these a little bit. I don't want to give away anything that happens, mm-hmm. but in particular, the Irfan Khan story something strange is starting to go on between Sunil and his daughter-in-law. Whether Paul is able to see that or not becomes a very important part of that story, and whether this character has any epiphanies or not is probably left to the viewer to decide, but it becomes much more plot-oriented probably than past seasons have been.
There's always been a gap between Paul as a therapist and Paul as a patient. Paul, the therapist, has so much empathy for the people he's talking to, and he's so aware of what they really mean and what they're really feeling in spite of what they're saying. But as a patient, he's just so clueless about what motivates him and so clueless about how rude he's usually being to his therapist. And it's always like one thing I've had trouble reconciling about the character of Paul. And I'm wondering how you plan on dealing with that in your season.
Well, I think it's something that our psychiatric consultant says can be very true.
Is that true, really?
Of him and his colleagues, that psychologists and psychiatrists don't always make the best patients and sometimes just revert to complete children once they enter the therapy room themselves. We were interested in this season that Paul is able to be less different in his own life and in the room. I mean, that the dark way he speaks of his work in that first episode is really a reflection of how he's feeling in his own life, not necessarily at work, but stuck, alone, unable to make a change. And as this season progresses, we were interested in sort of amping up that crisis, which they began in season one, and having him get to a darker and darker place where he's no longer sure that he can continue his work as a therapist effectively.
Like everybody, I mean, he's a liar, and he presents what puts him in the best light. Talking about Gina, he says, "Oh, you know, I'm happy for her," and Adele, probably for the first time in his life, really challenges him on that and doesn't let him get away with those sorts of lies. My mom is a psychoanalyst, and she used to say, sort of adding to what Anya said about therapists in their own therapy, but she used to say that you spend so much time as a psychoanalyst talking about parenting and how people are parented, and psychoanalysts are historically just the worst parents and blind to what they're doing with their own children. And that, to us, was interesting to explore.
Would you say that's true of your mother? And if your
Except
mother's
my
listening,
mother.
Put your hands
Except
over your ears.
Except, no, she would say this about other people.
Right. Of course.
No, she was terrific.
And Dan, did you lie to your therapist the way you say that a lot of patients do to theirs?
Whether consciously lying, I think probably give you more information than you want. My issue probably with my therapist was wanting to be a good patient. And, that probably comes from my, look how much progress I'm making. Look how open I am. Look how honest I am about myself. So that, which I think gets in the way of actually making progress. If I lied, that probably could have helped and sped things along a little bit.
Anya, you're studying psychotherapy, right?
I did. I found myself increasingly fed up with the television business in recent years and have always been interested in psychology. So I think it was last spring I enrolled in the marriage and family therapy program at Pepperdine University and thought maybe I would leave television writing behind. I took one class and then we got this job offer. And it was really probably the only show on television that would have made me at least take a break from the program and go back to writing.
What was so discouraging about working in television that you were ready to get out altogether and start a different profession?
I had worked on, I think I started off working on Homicide, the show that Danny and I met on, with Tom Fontana, who's really a wonderful man and a brilliant writer, and was incredibly nurturing and generous with people who worked for him. And I think I got a little bit spoiled. So then we came out to LA and I had other experiences which maybe weren't as either stimulating or loving. I was writing for shows that I wouldn't necessarily always watch on television, and I was frustrated and a little bit bored as well.
So how helpful is it to have been in therapy in order to write the show? Are you actually drawing from your own experiences?
I do think that, as Danny said before, that the type of heavily psychoanalytic therapy that we'd experienced and that we'd, you know, sort of adhere to would be very hard to replicate on the show. And so it was frustrating sometimes to be writing, you know, what we knew wasn't accurate based on our experience or wasn't necessarily the best kind of therapy. Because I think that I had come to believe that the less said by the therapist, the better, which I don't think Gabriel Byrne would have appreciated and wouldn't have been very dramatic. I'd say in some ways the therapy started to veer more towards what I encountered in Los Angeles, you know, shopping around for therapists here and all of a sudden they would speak up and say, oh, well, when I was in my 20s, and I say, shh, you're not supposed to be saying anything. Well, why are you talking? Or they'd even go so far as to say, here's what I think you should do, which would never have happened in my prior experience. But sometimes on occasion did happen on In Treatment. But at least Paul was always very aware that he was breaking the rules.
In talking about writing, do you see In Treatment as writing more for a play or a TV series? It's always a two-character thing. Basically, it's two people sitting in a chair and talking to each other, which nowadays is very un-TV-like because things move much more quickly on TV.
We were very aware in contemplating whether or not to take this on that most of the writers who'd been involved in the past were playwrights. There was Warren Light, Marcia Norman wrote last year, Jackie Rheingold, and then Sarah Treem, who wrote our two favorite storylines from the first two seasons. It was Sophie the Gymnast the first season and April from last season. She wrote the Jesse storyline here. She's also a playwright. Whereas Danny and I had no experience in that medium, and it was daunting to us, the idea of not being able to escape with a cut to another scene was very, very scary.
Oh, I never thought of that. Why is that scary?
Oh, it's so much better. You can write, you know, two or three pages and then cut to somebody running down a street and cut to another character talking and leave things sort of as a cliffhanger. But this really, as you said, it's like a two-character, one-act play that hopefully within it has some act changes. And we had a lot of discussion, both first with Haggai and then with Sarah Treem, about how to structure that half hour of television in a way that it moved naturally and dramatically. And it was something we definitely had to learn by writing.
Haggai did talk about it as a three-act play. You know, first where the character comes in and says what they want to talk about and their version of what they're there for. And then the second act where, you know, Paul probes and you get to hear what it is they're really there for. And then a third act where there's some sort of summation or analysis on Paul's part. And we didn't stick always so tightly to that form, but it was very helpful to have it diving in.
Anya, you're from a writing family. Casablanca was written by your grandfather, Philip Epstein, and his identical twin. Your great-uncle, mm-hmm. Julius Epstein. Your father, Leslie Epstein, directs the creative writing program at Boston University and has written several books. Did you grow up hearing a lot of talk about writing?
I did, and I grew up with frequent warnings from my dad to be anything but a writer. I obviously didn't heed his advice.
Why did he warn you away from it?
For him and for many of us, certainly for me, writing can be very, very hard and torturous sometimes. I think that I chose television writing because you couldn't afford to be tortured writing for television. You know, you had quick turnarounds, quick deadlines. It couldn't be perfect, and that somehow that was freeing for me.
So how old were you when you first saw Casablanca, which was written by your great uncle and your grandfather?
That's a good question because I have wondered whether my daughter, who's now 9, is old enough, and I think not, but probably sometime in my early teens.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think of it? How did you like it as a movie, and what did it mean to you that your family had written it?
Oh, at that age, I don't know. I do remember being surprised by how funny it was, that even at that young age, I got the jokes. And I once had the experience of watching it in Bryant Park, where there were, you know, thousands of people at those HBO movie screenings they do. And that was wonderful, sort of lying back under the New York City skyline and hearing people quoting the lines out loud and then also the laughter, which, you know, I think people think of that movie mostly as a romance and with some intrigue, but not at all as a comedy. And it really is very funny. But really, you know, intimidation was a large factor of, you know, how when you have that in your family, how on earth do you live up to that, and how would I dare write a word?
So. How did you overcome that intimidation?
Oh, I don't know. I by forcing myself to do it.
When you apply for like a writing position, like earlier in your career before you had a track record, when you applied for a writing position, did you let people know your lineage?
Oh no. I would have rather I get by on my own merits. I think I was too embarrassed to do that.
My guests, Dan Futterman and Anya Epstein, are the showrunners for this HBO series, Entreatment. And one of the storylines in the new season of Entreatment involves a middle-aged actress who's making a comeback in a Broadway production of Night of the Iguana. And she's having a great deal of difficulty remembering her lines, and this terrifies her. And, of course, there's all these other issues. But anyways, that actress is played by Deborah Winger. And although she was very famous early on for her roles in Urban Cowboy in terms of endearment, she, in the past few years, kind of dropped out more or less, except she was terrific in Rachel Getting Married as the mother of the bride. How did you decide to cast her? Was it your decision?
It was. I mean, we were interested in this story that deals with an actress who, in certain ways, has a slightly similar story to Deborah's story, just in a sort of overview of someone who was formerly quite famous, remains very talented, but as happens to many actresses, roles and opportunities kind of dry up in their 40s and 50s. And we thought, who would be the dream person to play this part? Do you think Deborah Winger would do it? And we had the talk with HBO about it. They were, of course, thrilled for us to take the chance, and so we begged her to do it, and she luckily agreed. She was really remarkably game to face all of the issues that this character is dealing with about a waning career, fears of aging, that I think many actresses would have shied away from. But she is bold and brave and open to any experience. And she was really a thrill to have a part of the show this year.
I like the way in this new season you've included a couple of people who are afraid that they're getting or might get a disease and how they deal with, should I go to the doctor, should I not go to that doctor? If the doctor tells me I don't have it, do I believe him? Or do I keep going to doctors until one of them tells me I do have it because I know that I have it? Why did you want to emphasize that?
I think that in particular happens with Gabriel's character, Paul Weston. We were looking for ways to sort of push him over the cliff that he's been teetering on the edge of for two seasons in terms of his frustrations with his career, his loneliness, and also his aging. And that felt like a very palpable way to do that and to see him become obsessed about some aspect of his life in a way that that his patients often are, and for him to be able to, as you say, deal in an objective and therapeutic and helpful way with people, but be blind to it in his own life. That felt exciting to us.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. It's been great to talk with you, and congratulations on the series.
Thank you so much.
Thank
it's
you,
a
Terry.
Total pleasure.
Dan Futterman and Anya Epstein are the showrunners for the HBO series In Treatment, which is shown Monday and Tuesday nights. Coming up, two movies, one about a 70s terrorist, one about the founder of Facebook. John Powers tells us what they reveal about changing social values. This is Fresh Air. The last few weeks have seen the release of two critically acclaimed movies, each exploring the career of a man who has entered popular mythology. David Fincher's The Social Network, which is in theaters everywhere, stars Jesse Eisenberg as Mark Zuckerberg, the creator of Facebook. Carlos, by the French director Olivier Assayas, is a 5.5-hour saga about the notorious 70s terrorist Carlos the Jackal. It's currently in selected theaters and available on demand through most cable companies. Our critic-at-large John Power says that seeing them side by side got him thinking about how much social values have changed over recent decades.
If you'd been born 1,000 years ago, or even 300, you would have lived your whole life in a society whose values were essentially those of your great-great-great-grandparents. These days, however, history moves at a dizzying speed. Ideas I once took for granted now seem as long gone as getting a telegram. The depth of this cultural change struck me as I was watching two of the year's most interesting films. Carlos, Olivier Assayas' historical thriller about the 70s terrorist Carlos the Jackal, and David Fincher's breezy The Social Network, which centers on Mark Zuckerberg, the Harvard undergrad behind Facebook. While their stories could hardly sound more different, the movies have striking similarities, and not only because the filmmakers freely admit to fictionalizing things. Both Carlos and Zuckerberg are young anti-heroes who remain ciphers. Both are narcissistic outsiders who profess idealism while behaving unidealistically. And above all, both embody key fantasies of the very different eras in which they became famous. Beginning in 1972, Carlos charts the violent rise and seedy fall of Caracas-born Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, who dubbed himself Carlos, a charismatic political gangster played with great animal cunning by Edgar Ramirez. Whether working with Marxist Palestinians or the East German secret police, Carlos styled himself a revolutionary, and he went about his work with sociopathic ruthlessness. He murdered cops, blew up cafes and trains, and in a spectacular 1975 coup that the film captures brilliantly, he kidnapped the OPEC ministers in Vienna and ferried them by jet to Algiers. It's an amazing story and one told with gripping lucidity. Here, early on, Carlos offers his services to a leader from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine.
Arafat is the traitor. He is ready to make any kind of compromise. Our organization serves the Palestinian revolution. The cowards that betrayed it are our enemies.
I live in London. I can be very useful there. Mohamed Moudia, who headed operations in Europe, was executed by Israeli agents from the Mossad. I believe I can replace him.
You are still a boy. I need men.
So you don't trust me because I'm young?
You have to prove yourself. We will give you a mission.
What mission?
Andre will tell you. Andre is a fighter I've chosen as the Moudia successor. He's in Paris now. He will contact you.
When?
In time.
Despite his big words, Carlos had all the principles of a barracuda. He was basically in it for himself. But his gaudy crimes touched something in the zeitgeist, and the media conspired to dress him in an aura of rock star cool. You see, this was an age that still believed in liberation movements, an age in which countless millions, many of them young, dreamed that the world could be saved by political revolution. Back then, the idea that Barack Obama is a communist would have had even Ronald Reagan laughing. Be that as it may, Assayas makes it clear that Carlos never came close to liberating anybody. Utterly without a mass following, his supposedly revolutionary violence actually did very little, except discredit the left. Far from advancing a cause, Carlos's adventurism merely popularized a tactic. He's one of the founding fathers of today's globalized terrorism. The Social Network's Mark Zuckerberg is also a founding father. But man, have times changed. Where 40 years ago such a brainy young misfit might have been drawn to left-wing politics, that idea seems almost absurd in today's America, even at liberal Harvard. Despite the financial crisis, our culture still celebrates the values of a go-go capitalism, in which Warren Buffett is treated as a seer, and you're more likely to overhear conversation about a new iPhone app than about the war in Afghanistan. In keeping with the spirit of the age, Zuckerberg's fantasy isn't toppling the system, it's being successful within it. More attuned to code than ideas, he not only invents Facebook in 2004, but he fights to retain control of it, a process that includes turning friends into foes, waging battles in court, and insulting anybody he thinks dumber than he is, meaning everybody. Along the way, he makes himself the youngest billionaire in history, and influences the daily lives of Facebook's 500 million users. If Carlos was the terrorist as rock star, Zuckerberg is a nerd messiah, an uncool guy who, sitting in his dorm room, has changed how we live to an extent that the globe-trotting radical Carlos could only dream of. Not that this makes him happy, at least according to The Social Network, which views Zuckerberg's entrepreneurial ascent as coolly as Assayas does Carlos's terrorism. The movie ends with the young tycoon, hugely successful and wealthy. Not a nice guy, but one of the kings of our culture. In his triumph, he seems a far cry from Carlos, who, by the time he's finally caught and imprisoned, has sunk into debauchery and irrelevance. Of course, if the jackal were a more generous soul, he might consider friending Zuckerberg, just to give him an avuncular heads-up on how quickly, in our hyper-fast modern world, a man's historical moment can fade away.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.